what do socialists say about privilege theory? I will try to remain fraternal, as we always do when arguing about different ideas and stuff, but I do have to admit that there are many aspects of privilege theory which I find very difficult and which really infuriate me. So if I tip over onto that side, and if you got me separately in the pub, I probably would definitely tip over into abuse. I do apologise. I don't want this to be a dry theoretical discussion at all, because I think, like any theory, privilege theory is best put to the test in practice, really. And therefore, I want to start with the events in Ferguson, and I think even if people haven't had a chance yet to read the excellent coverage in Socialist Worker, they will have seen it in the news and been outraged by basically the racist murder of Michael Brown by the police, the subsequent smearing of his character and of his whole community by the authorities, and the absolutely frightening militaristic police response. The militaristic police response has been frightening to what are basically mass protests that have been every day since the killing. And I just think this is yet another example of how racist the US state and its institutions remain. You know, some people are questioning how this can happen in a country that now has its first black president, but clearly there's a vast divide between Obama, who's very much part of the establishment, and ordinary black youngsters like Michael Brown, or people will remember Trayvon Martin a couple of years ago. Obama may have sort of mildly chastised the police, that they may have been slightly out of order, but really it rings a little bit hollow, really. And I think as revolutionary socialists, we have quite a clear understanding of where that racism and inequality come from, that we have to fight racism, sexism and homophobia wherever they raise their ugly head. But at the same time, we recognise it's only united mass struggle by the working class that will permanently overcome that division, the scapegoating and inequality. But not everyone has the same response to racism and events like those in Ferguson. There was an otherwise excellent piece by someone called Roxanne Gay in The Guardian, only a small piece about the killing of Michael Brown, and she states in it, "Today I truly understand privilege," but she doesn't explicitly explain what she means by that. It's a good article, but she doesn't go into the detail of why she thinks that is the issue. And after the killing of Trayvon Martin in 2012, some white people, along with black people, wore t-shirts with the slogan, "I am Trayvon Martin," and that was in solidarity with him and other people persecuted and murdered by the police. And some others said that they didn't have the right to do that because, as white people, they were part of the problem, which I think is looking at things completely the wrong way, really. You know, after Ian Tomlinson was killed by the police in London on a protest that he was actually nothing to do with, we raised, I think, if I remember rightly, the slogan, "We are all Ian Tomlinson," and nobody, it would have been ridiculous for people to say, "Oh, well, we weren't a man who sold newspapers, you know, so we have no right to say anything about it." You know, we have a different perspective where you stand together on these issues. So I realise it's difficult. I know that these are emotive issues, and I think in some ways the extent of things and the way that people are still segregated in parts of America are different to what they are here, and I don't want to downplay the extent of that racism in the US and certain states in particular, but I do believe that looking at these issues through that prism of privilege is not the answer. But I think I need to go back a few steps and explain exactly what people mean by privilege, and where that theory originates. It is a theory that mainly came out of the US, but is sort of taking hold and being quite popular with some of the young activists in Britain today, and I think that's where it might have cropped up. People might have come across it. We certainly have in Sheffield. So in this instance, what Roxanne Gay is perhaps referring to in Ferguson, it's the idea that all white people benefit from racism. If black people are oppressed, then it must mean therefore that white people are privileged, and then therefore even those who are white and ardently anti-racist are still seen to be benefiting from unearned and often unnoticed privileges just because they're white. And the same goes for men who campaign against sexism. They may be part of campaigns for equal pay or abortion rights, but by people who go with this theory, they're still seen as actually being part of the problem because they're automatically benefiting from women's oppression simply by being men. And the origins of this theory lie in the fragmentation of the movement following the real high point of struggles for liberation in the late 60s and early 70s that people will be aware of. And as the movement disintegrated, different groups turned in on each other. What happened, I think, was many activists either became incorporated into the system, into the Democratic Party in the US or the Labour Party here in Britain, whilst others went on to set up often women's studies or black studies departments in academic institutions. And it's in these departments that you find the theory first of male privilege and then white privilege began to emerge. And a key theorist in this area is Peggy McIntosh, and she wrote a paper, White Privilege: Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. And in this, she develops the idea of white privilege from a starting point of the idea of male privilege, which she feels she experiences at work in her college or university, I'm not sure which, and then she expands that onto the issue of race. She approaches it from an individual point of view, and she openly admits that. It's shown in the title of the original paper that she wrote, which is White Privilege and Male Privilege, a personal account of coming to see correspondences through work in women's studies. I'm not even totally sure what that title in academic speak means, to be honest, but I think I've got an idea that she's trying to equate the two in her own personal world. And so she starts off by stating that in her own academic setting, women are disadvantaged in the curriculum, which therefore means that men must be overadvantaged, overprivileged. So although her male colleagues agree that women are underrepresented in the curriculum, they will not admit that they benefit from that underrepresentation. So this goes back to a sort of much older argument about whether men benefit from women's oppression. And I'll try and come back to that a little bit later. So for Peggy McIntosh, this led to some sort of eureka moment where she realised that perhaps as a white woman, whilst she was previously fully aware of racism and the disadvantages it put black people at, she realised that perhaps she had also been benefiting from a white privilege that she'd been hitherto unaware of. So she goes on, depending on which paper you read, to list either 46 or 50 examples of unearned benefits that she felt she experienced on a daily basis that she feels can be more attributed to what she calls skin colour privilege than to any other factor, including class. Although she does acknowledge that different factors are interlinked and may be sort of playing into it. And she refers to this in the title of the shorter paper, as I said initially, as the invisible knapsack. And she says, "I've come to see that white privilege as an invisible package of unearned assets that I can count on cashing in each day, but about which I was meant to remain oblivious. White privilege is like an invisible weightless knapsack of special provisions, assurances, tools, maps, guides, code books, passports, visas, clothes, compass, emergency gear, and blank checks." And she lists, the things that she lists, I think in one way, can be seen as an examination of how racism works in everyday life. So some of the examples are things like, she says, "I can turn on the television or open the front page of the paper and see people of my own race widely represented." Or another one is, "If a traffic cop pulls me over or if the IRS audits my tax return, I can be sure I haven't been singled out because of my race." So yeah, it's that's right, and it's, she's right to expose those things. But other things on the list I think are slightly more dubious. So one of them, she says, if I should need to move, I can be pretty sure of renting or purchasing housing in an area which I can afford and in which I would want to live. So although there may be an element of race to that decision and that choice, and probably much more so in the US where she was writing, I think it's also, in that instance, much more likely to be down to class. Many people are priced out of the housing market altogether or forced into housing in areas they would not choose if money wasn't an object to them. And I think particularly in Britain today, with the advent of the bedroom tax and benefit capping, you can see that choice getting further and further restricted, really. You know, there's been the threat of people being moved out of their homes, and in some cases even they're expecting people to move to another city. And I don't think any of that can be purely based on race. So the focus of McIntosh's writing, and I do wonder whether she intended this to be turned into a full-blown theory or ever expected that's what would happen, the focus is on the privileged having to give up something in order for the oppressed to gain something, a sort of redressing of the balance. And there are major problems with this approach, and that's what I'm going to talk about. And it's also the point when you read some of her papers where you do start to want to bang your head against the wall a little bit. And it also made me really grateful that we have, you know, good publications like the Socialist Review and the IHJ, where we can put forward a clear analysis of these theories and a clear strategy of how we think we should fight to overcome oppression. So I think the first problem with privilege theory is that it focuses on individuals becoming aware of their alleged privilege instead of focusing on what we can actually overdo to overcome massive inequalities in the system, or ultimately overcome the system itself. I find it a very demotivating theory that focuses on guilt and on blame, individual guilt and blame. And some theorists state that if those who are supposedly privileged are uncomfortable when presented with statements like those that McIntosh makes, it's because they're being confronted with the unearned benefits which they're in denial about. So therefore they need to, and this is the phrase that you may hear, they need to check their privilege. And this is a term I will come back to. So the focus is about challenging and changing individual behaviour, a theory that does nothing to unite people of different race, gender, sexuality in a common fight. In fact, really, it's quite the opposite. Some, such as an author called Frances Kendall, go as far to say, any of us who has race privilege is racist by definition. I also think there are more fundamental problems even than that, and not least is understanding the difference between privileges and rights. And I think it's easiest to knock down some of these theories by looking at some current and recent examples. So in the case of racism, is it really a privilege for a white person not to be shot dead by the police or by vigilantes, or is that a basic right, really? You know, another example, yes, we know that a grossly disproportionate number of black and Asian men get stopped and searched, but should we be seeking to redress the balance by letting police stop more white men or perhaps more women? Or would it be better if we just stopped harassing people in that way altogether? And a great example, I think, that busts the myth of male privilege and really starts to show the theory as a non-starter in terms of equality is, people might remember the single status pay dispute, 5-10 years ago, in local government, which in many ways was the embodiment, turned into the embodiment of the idea that men had an unearned privilege and they needed to give some of that up in order for women to become equal. And that proved massively damaging in the fight to finally implement the Equal Pay Act of 30 years previously, because many local authorities, because they weren't given money from central government, made a bid to balance the books and do that. Then rather than upping women's wages, they thought, to meet those of men, they thought it would be easier to lower men's wages, and actually in some cases that those of better paid women should also be cut down to the lowest common denominator. And that really is a strategy that benefits neither men or women. And actually the councils where workers did win gains, such as in Birmingham, where workers, male and female, stood against the threat and took united strike action, which shows the way that you can win. Another issue I feel with privilege theory is that while many theorists will stick to the key inequalities to apply it to, which are generally seen as race, gender, sexuality and disability, it can become almost a case of ever decreasing circles and something of a league table of oppression and privilege. So something called the Transformative Justice Law Project of Illinois states many different forms of privilege that activists need to be aware of and to check. So they say there are things called education privilege, body size privilege, life on the outside privilege, which is the privilege of not being in prison, and passing and passing privilege, which is the privilege to be able to pass as a more privileged group, for instance, a light-skinned person of colour, passing as white. And this really, I think, is just absolutely a road to nowhere, but in some ways it is the logical conclusion if you start to go down this route of privilege theory. And we saw this play out in Sheffield in the student movement in the years following the big student demos of 2010, as the movement sort of shrunk back and started to fall apart. Many of the young activists became solely focused on oppression and liberation politics, and in organising meetings that we had and tried to support our students, our Swiss students in, they were organising for a march against sexism that was organised after some nasty incidents on campus. There were big rows about whether men should be allowed on the march. There were constant calls for non-sexist men who were there because they wanted to be involved in the united and progressive movement. They were constantly called on to, as I said before, check their privilege. A phrase, I mean, you can't, until you actually hear that in practice being used to disarm somebody who's there because they want to fight together with people for a common cause, it absolutely makes your blood boil, to be honest. People were saying, okay, we don't mind if men are there, but we don't want them to shout too loudly. Many male activists felt they had to precede their contributions and suggestions for how we should organise by with a qualifier. It could be along the lines of, okay, I know I'm a man here, but I'm a gay man, and so to see us, oh yes, that's okay, you know, that's all right, we don't mind if you're here, kind of thing. Some point, you know, felt they needed to point out that they had a disability, and I don't want to kind of sound disparaging, but I feel like it becomes a kind of depressing parody of the Four Yorkshiremen sketch to me, to be honest. Like, people are trying to, you know, outdo each other in terms of how oppressed they are. It's not really a path to how you're going to fight. So, to cut a long story short, somewhere along the way in this march, the positive success I felt of men and women, young men and women marching together through the centre of Sheffield on a Saturday afternoon, and this was in the week that the Sheffield footballer Ched Evans was actually sentenced for rape. So to see those people marching through the centre of town, taking a stand together against sexism and chanting together loud and clear that no means no, the meaning of that and the success of that was lost. And apparently the argument that took place in the aftermath, that was because men were too near the front of the march and they shouted too loudly. So, you know, it's just one example, but I think these examples are crucial because they show how theories like privilege theory are not going to take us forward. And there's one more problem, and it's quite a big one with the theory. For socialists, it's a massive problem that privilege theorists see class as just another category on a list. It's only one of the ways that people can have an alleged privilege over others. But for us, it's really the key. If you want to talk about real unearned privilege, it's not working class men who have privilege over working class women. But I've heard one phrase, and I always get it the wrong way around, but it's like tuppence halfpenny looking down on tuppence, which I think is quite a good way of describing it, where you've got the millionaires laughing, you know, all the way to the bank. Neither is it working class white people having privilege over working class black people. It's the absolute unearned privilege of the ruling class and what they hold over the rest of us, and the way that they use our differences to divide us, to keep us down, stop us from sticking together and ultimately overthrowing them. So I think it's easy for middle class US academics to say that men have privilege over women. And one of the things that McIntosh and others say is that a man can expect his boss to also be a man, as if that's somehow some kind of advantage, that gives them some kind of solidarity. You know, another example, but in the hospital where I work, I represented a male union member who worked as a domestic, being disciplined for his sickness record. He was a man who was over 60, a carer for his disabled wife, as well as having mental health issues of his own. He was unable to read and write, which was contributing to some of his stress and anxiety at work. His supervisors and managers are predominantly female. The people who we went into the meeting with who were disciplining him over his sickness were female. The person from HR was female. You know, it's not just impossible, but I think highly offensive to suggest that he had an unearned privilege, either over any of his female colleagues, over his bosses, over me as his union rep, or for that matter, over his wife. You know, it's an anecdotal story, but it shows that people don't fit into the boxes that privilege theory would like to put them into, really.
That's the problem.
And, you know, class cannot just be dismissed as another form of oppression. It is something quite different from that. It can be characterised that socialists just see fighting oppression as a distraction from the class struggle, but really I think to suggest that is an insult as well, when, you know, SWP members in particular are at the forefront of struggles against racism, sexism and homophobia, and constantly pushing for united movements against the likes of UKIP, the BNP, the EDL. What it actually comes down to is that we recognise that it's the working class that actually have the power to change things, but for that to be possible we need to be able to unite and to overcome differences, to fight for each other's rights and take away the only real privilege that there is, which, as I said, is that of the parasitic ruling class, really. And I think rather than collectivise the struggle, privilege theory only serves to further divide us and individualise the problems. Now, this is not to say that we can't work with people who accept and put forward these theories within campaigns, but we do need to, I think, remain upfront about our politics and not hide our differences.
Okay.